If you want to find out about classical queers, then you're in the right place with Alice and Jaheed.
Yeah! That was beautiful. Okay. Wait, what is the name of our podcast?
Oh, we don't have a name yet, do we?
Oh my god. Okay, well, I was talking with Sam and Richie, and of the three names that I have in our little binder, they liked Tchaikovsky and Classical Queeros the best. I feel like Classical Queeros is the one I'm leaning toward the most.
I'm leaning towards that one.
Okay, all right, then we're just going to go with that for now. Right. We can change it later if we need to. All right, hello, welcome. This is the first episode of Classical Queeros, a podcast which did not have a name 3 seconds ago. This is a podcast where two gay people of color de-straighten the history of classical music by highlighting queer composers and more.
I'm Shahid Osuna, and I'm a Mexican grad student in LA, and I'm hella gay.
And I'm Alice Park, and I am half Korean. I'm also hella gay. I'm not a grad student, but we both play flute, and I like to say that I think that we are the best power duo flute people.
Hell yeah.
since the Dopplers, and in fact, better, because they were brothers, and we're just like gay soul sisters, you know?
Yeah, we're gay soul sisters.
Exactly. So that's who we are.
Power duo.
Yes, and I'm super excited to start today. Classical music deserves to be better. Gay. Yes, oh, yeah, gay. Yeah. Both those things, gay and better, which are the same thing. So today we'll be talking about a composer from Victorian England, a proud, fierce lesbian named Ethel Smyth, who I'm pretty sure I was in a past life.
Oh my god, you so were.
You don't even know anything about her yet.
I know, but I'm looking at this picture that we have up of her, and it's like, oh my god,
what a power pose. But anyway, before we talk about her, we have a question in our opening segment, what do you say, gay? In each episode, we'll just start out with a cute little icebreaker question, because we're here to dismantle classism and bring some silliness back into our world.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, so our question today is for both of us, and it's, who is your queer role model?
Oh my gosh.
So why don't you go first?
Me go first? Yeah. Okay. That is such a hard question. I have a lot.
Mm-hmm.
I had some teachers when I was in high school who were openly gay.
Oh,
and
that's so sweet.
Yeah. And I even had a teacher who I didn't have personally, but came out as trans.
What?
While I was there.
That's awesome.
And it was so inspiring to have someone in this town where I grew up, where it was mostly really Christian conservative, uh-huh. very they weren't very friendly to people like me.
Mm.
And still have adults who I could look up to and mm-hmm.
That's so
and relate
nice.
To in a way. Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
So they I have definitely those teachers in my life that inspired me and were such a role model for me. But also Madonna.
Oh my god. Yeah.
When I was a little boy, my dad would put on Madonna music videos, and I definitely came out of my sexual shell watching Madonna's 90 videos where she was just all over the place, and I'm like, that's so me.
That's beautiful.
Hashtag inspired.
Hashtag inspired. Hashtag thank you, Madonna.
Hashtag thanks, Madonna.
Oh my god. I think it's so cool that you had teachers at your school who were out in their various ways, and a trans teacher. In my high school, in my entire life in school, all my teachers were white. All my teachers were straight. I didn't meet another gay person until high school, at which point the only out people were these two dudes I knew who I just wasn't a fan of personally.
Uh-huh.
I mean, it might have just been a little bit of internalized homophobia. They were just being themselves, and I'm just wow, I don't want a part of that. I've learned since, I promise. But, yeah, I didn't really have anybody, and I just think that's so cool that there were teachers, plural, that you could look up to like that. That's so cool.
Totally. Yeah. Yeah. I discovered this recently, that wasn't a common thing.
Mm-hmm.
Because my partner, Charles, he also went to a school in San Diego, and he was I was one of the very few out kids in my class.
Mm-hmm.
And I was really? Because in my school, in my program, by the senior year, my band leadership was like almost completely like gay.
Oh my God.
We had like trans people. It was like such a diverse group of people.
Wow.
It
was beautiful.
It was so like, I didn't have any like second thought to it, but uh-huh. I was really privileged to be in a place where I had the opportunity to be myself and had people to support me. So I'm really grateful for that.
Oh, that's so nice. Oh my gosh.
But who is your queer role model?
Oh my God. Okay. So originally I was going to say Hayley Kiyoko, and she's still pretty much my answer.
Yes.
Yes. But the reason why I'm like, I don't know now is because now that I've learned so much about Ethel Smythe, like, she's amazing. And since I'm pretty sure, again, like I said, that I was her in a past life, that like, I don't know. You'll see. I think she's so cool. So she's kind of like my backup role model. But Hayley Kiyoko, Hayley Kiyoko is like really important to me because she is one of like the few half Asian people that I have ever seen in like the public, you know? There's not a lot of faces that look like me. Actually, I was just thinking because we were rewatching Hamilton earlier, and Philippa Soo, who plays Eliza, is also half Asian. And it's just like, I recognize my privilege. I like, when it comes to racism, I know that as a half white, half Korean person that I got it pretty easy, but it can be a little bit lonely to like not feel like I'm enough of either thing. And just to like see a face that looks like mine. I don't see faces like that ever, you know, even my cousins are like either full Korean or half Korean, half Mexican. And just like, nobody looks like me. So it's cool. It's really cool. First of all, to just see a face that looks like that. That's like, oh my God, I'm allowed to be here. Second of all, she's lesbian Jesus, so how, you know...
Of course.
I have no choice. And, like, she's super, like... She's always ready to just be exactly who she is and wear the clothes she wants to wear and act how she wants to act. She's not going to be, like a woman the way that society wants her to be, or a lesbian the way that society wants her to be. She's Hayley Kiyoko. That's who she is. And then her music is just so good, and... For a long time, every time she released a new single, it would like be about something that was happening in my life that I needed to hear right in that moment.
That's so amazing.
Yeah, it's like she really is lesbian Jesus, because she knew she was there. She was watching out for me.
She was. Yeah. She was a guardian angel.
I know.
Guardian Jesus angel.
My guardian lesbian Jesus angel. Yeah.
She was like writing songs. She's like, I got you, Alice.
Yeah.
Listen to this next song on this album.
Yeah. Oh my God. So Hayley Kiyoko is my queer role model, but Ethel Smythe is a close second.
Oh my God, I'm so excited to learn about her.
Yeah, okay, so we're gonna take a quick break. Okay, so today we're going to talk about Ethel Smythe. She was a composer in Victorian England. None of y'all podcast listeners can see this, but I have up here a photo of Ethel Smythe when she was younger. And like, all the photos when you look her up are like this older British woman who kind of looks like she's like Maggie Smith. And it's like, she's just looks respectable and stuff, but that's not who she was. And this photo that I'm looking at right now, like, how do I describe this? She's wearing like a nice tweed suit. I'm pretty sure that's not a skirt. I'm pretty sure those are pants.
The power.
Yeah. And she's got like a hat on, her hair is tied back, so it looks like it's short. And she's got like one hand casually in her pocket and the other arm slung across like the back of the bench that she's sitting on.
And so gay.
The gayest. And she has this look on her face that's like, yeah. I'm here. I know who I am. Like, it's just so, this photo is so good.
I love it.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
So here's just like a little, a couple things. She was an English composer who was born in April 28th, 1858, and she died May 8th, 1944. Dame Ethel Smythe was an out lesbian and suffragette and was someone who never apologized for who she was, woman, lesbian, composer, or anything. I want to start by mentioning how it was really hard to find information on, like, her sexuality when I was reaching. I knew that she was gay because I had seen her on, like, a list from Classic FM or something.
Uh-huh.
But so when I Googled Ethel Smythe, every single thing that came up at first just talked about her, like, her career as a musician or this time that she got arrested for protesting for women's voting rights, which we'll talk about later.
Right.
And they're like, oh yeah, I'll happily mention this time she got arrested, but I will not mention her relationships with women.
Oh my gosh.
And so I couldn't find anything until I added gay to my search result. And oftentimes, the only thing that I found was this one sentence. Smythe was public about her nonconformist sexual identity.
Oh my God.
Like, what? I know. What? Like, there are better ways to say she was gay. Like, it's not a weird thing. And it wasn't uncommon. Also, she literally wrote 10 books in the later half of her life, most of which are autobiographical, and still they make it this hard for us to find it. Like, she made it so easy for us to know what it was like to be her. She wrote 10 books on her life, and yet we're just like, okay, what? Oh my God, I had no idea. A lot of my information I got from one of her books, her first one, actually. It's called Impressions That Remained. I'm enjoying it so much. I'm like, I want to say 22% of the way through the book, because I'm reading it online, so it'll tell you. And she's so funny and so unstuffy. Like, you'd think it would be stuffy, especially considering how, like, male composers of her time would, like, talk about anything.
Yes.
Oh my God. But she was so unstuffy, and I love her so much. So let's just go into it. She was the fourth of 8 kids.
Wow, big family.
Yeah, big family. And there was, like, a pretty big age gap, as far as I understand. Her eldest sister, the oldest child, was named Alice.
So, oh my God.
Yeah, so Fate. Proof. I know. Just a tiny note on her sister Alice, because I thought it was funny. In her book, she said, Alice supposed never to have been naughty in her life. And her goodness, one governess said, was positively monotonous. So, like, is that me? Maybe. Ethel, on the other hand, her mom nicknamed her the Stormy Petrel.
I love it.
Yes, because she she got in trouble with the boys all the time, you know?
What is a petrel?
That's a great question. Wait, let me find out. Oh my God, I can't type. Define petrel.
Thank you, Google.
A seabird related to the shearwaters, typically flying far from land.
Wow. She was a stormy bird.
Stormy bird. I mean, aren't we all? Okay. So, in reading her books a lot, I noticed that she seemed to have, like, a similar, like, outlook on genders as a kid that I also did, which is that, like, she's like, I'm not like the other girls because I'm more tomboyish and adventurous, but I'm also better than the boys because I'm a girl. Like, that was kind of her thing.
I love it.
Yeah. And she never let, like, boys being boys or girls being girls in that time, like, stop her from doing whatever she wanted.
Yeah.
I remember once when I was, like, when I was younger, before puberty, one of my younger brothers, he was 3 years younger than me, and he and his friends would play football, and I would play with them because I liked to play football. And then as I got older, they wouldn't let me play with them anymore, and that was, like, around puberty-ish time. Uh-huh. So it's, like, I kind of get it, but also at the same time, just let me play football.
Yeah.
I like throwing. I like running around. I just, you know.
So, Alice loves running around.
Alice loves running around, but only on my own terms. Anyway.
The binary.
Yeah. So anyway.
That's awesome.
I have a couple quotes from her book, which demonstrate how I think she probably knew she was gay pretty early on. Here's one. I have said I was subject to passions, as I called them, and about this... Wait, should I read this in a British accent?
I really think you should, yeah.
Oh my God, okay. So, this is a quote from Ethel's book, Impressions That Remain. I have said I was subject to passions, as I called them, and about this time drew up a list of over 100 girls and women to whom, had I been a man, I should have proposed. And at this time that she's talking about, she was like 12.
What?
Yeah.
I love it.
Yeah, I know. She's just like, oh my God, these women are so beautiful. I'm going to propose to them now, except I can't because I'm a man, but like, I totally would. You know? Here's another thing which makes her like kind of a disaster lesbian. Okay. At this stage of existence, again, around 12-ish, I stood in great awe of my father, but adored my mother, and remember her dazzling apparitions at our bedside when she would come to kiss us goodnight before starting for an evening party. I often lay sleepless and weeping at the thought of her one day growing old and less beautiful, which is like...
Don't we all?
Yeah! That's pretty gay, but it's also about her mom. But anyway, we're gonna keep going. Besides this, wild passions for girls and women a great deal older than myself made up a large part of my emotional life, and it was my habit to increase the anguish of my love by fancifying its object was prey to some terrible disease that would shortly snatch her from me. And like, honestly, disaster lesbian, but I also get it. Like, you're just like, oh my God, I'm in love with this woman and everything is great. Except, wait, she's probably going to die of disease tomorrow. Yeah.
True.
Yeah. So she started piano at age 10 because, like, playing piano in your own home was, like, a common thing. You know, that's how you would hear music. Otherwise, you're not going to. But she stopped mostly at age 12 from a knife injury on her left hand.
Disaster lesbian.
Yeah. So what happened was her parents were gone and she was like, I want to make toffee. So she tried to make toffee but forgot to put butter on the thing. So it stuck when it came out of the oven.
Gosh.
And she was holding it in her left hand, like the tray. And she had a knife in her right hand and was just pressing down to try to pry it off.
God.
And it slipped. And she like cut down to the bone on her thumb.
Oh my God.
Yeah. And it was awful. And it healed and whatever and she's fine. But so she couldn't play piano after that. However, the quote that she said in her book was, after that, I could only span an octave in my left hand. So it's like, wait, I can only reach an octave. I don't know. I think you're fine. Okay. So moving on, she discovered classical music at age 12, as opposed to like folk music and singing in her home and whatever. From her book, she said, I have said that the whole course of my life was determined, little as she realized it, by one of our governesses. When I was 12, a new victim arrived who had studied music at the Leipzig Conservatorium, then in the heyday of its reputation in England. For the first time, I heard classical music and a new world opened up before me. Shortly after, a friend having given me Beethoven's sonatas, I began studying the easier of these. I lost my spot. The easier of these, and walked into the new world on my own feet. Thus was my true bent subtly revealed to me, and I then and there conceived the plan, carried out 7 years later, of study at Leipzig and giving up my life to music.
Wow.
Yeah. So, like, at 12, she was just like, I did it, I found it, this is what I'm gonna do. And then she did.
Yeah.
She did.
She just went for it.
Yeah. She studied on her own, like, by studying these Beethoven sonatas and whatever, and, like, anything that she could find on her own for years until she was, like, 17 when she studied with a family friend. And after that, that's when she went to Leipzig. She did. She went to that conservatory that the governess came from.
That's amazing.
Also, cute little gay fact. She used to write little compositions all the time and name each of them after one of her passions.
Yeah. The original mixtape.
Yeah. So she had crushes on so many people. She probably had so many compositions just to make up, like, you know, to have one for each girl. I can't. Okay.
A suite.
Mm-hmm.
A suite of passions.
Of passions, yes. So here, the next bit I included here because I just thought it was interesting. So many queer women don't figure out until later that they're queer. And that's not true for everybody, of course, but that was the case for me. Many of us go through, like, compulsory heteronormativity, as you know, and, you know, kind of, like, being like, okay, yeah, this guy likes me, he's nice, there's nothing wrong with him, I could fall in love with him, I guess, and then you just do what you think, like, you should be doing.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Based on what society tells you to do.
Yeah.
Of course.
Yeah, so she kind of did that. At age around 17 or 18, she had a brief affair with Oscar Wilde's brother, Willie Wilde, who after,
what?
Yeah, and after like 2 days of knowing each other, he proposed on a boat in secret and then sent her love letters for 3 weeks.
Oh my God.
Yeah, like she had fun hanging out with him and he was nice to her and she was just like, well, he's kind because he saw me seasick and he still proposed, so I guess that's true love. And he proposed, when he was in the middle of proposing, he was sitting on the boat, like, on this little tin can, which in the middle of him proposing, like, slipped and fell. And he just kind of, like, brushed it off and kept going. And she was like, well, he's got a sense of humor and he can roll with the punches. So she's like, all right, I guess I'll, yeah. So they went ring shopping. He got her a ring, but he was like, you have to keep it secret for now. So she wore a glove to hide it.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, and then they parted ways. Well, she went back home, and he went back home, and he sent her love letters for 3 weeks. And then at the end of those 3 weeks, she was like, you know what? I think I don't want to do this, but can I keep the ring as a souvenir?
As a souvenir.
Yeah.
I love it.
Yeah. And so she was just kind of like, yeah. I mean, she knew the whole time she wasn't in love with him, but she was just like, yeah, whatever. I guess this is fine.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Might as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she actually did meet Oscar Wilde during this very brief affair.
Worth it.
Yeah.
Except for the love letters. That's a lot.
Yeah, but you know, it's fine. Like, he wasn't a person of the love letters. Imagine having to, like, be a lesbian in that time and then stand there while a man just professed his love for you for, like, 3 weeks, you know?
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, he's like, my love, you art thou like the greatest flower in the garden. And she's like,
Thank God we can block numbers now.
Yeah! Oh, man. Okay. Yeah, so that was cool. Her dad was a military general who, like, he was loving, but they were never super close. And he didn't want her involved in music for various reasons. And at age 17, she argued with her dad. And at that point, it's unclear. At that point, he either graciously allowed her to pursue music or she just left and did it anyway.
Uh-huh.
Either way, iconic. and she went to study at the Leipzig Conservatory for 1 year under Karl Reinecke.
Ooh.
Reinecke? Reinecke.
Is it? That's a good question. We should know.
We should know, but...
I've never played that piece. Was it Undine?
Yeah, the Undine Sonata.
I've never played it before.
You know what? That's fine.
Carl. Anyway,
under Carl. a well-known composer who's written flute music that neither of us has played. So, I think it's so funny. Well, the Wikipedia page said, she left after a year, however, disillusioned with the low standard of teaching, and continued her music studies privately with Heinrich von Erzogenberg. I just think it's so funny that it's like Karl Reinecke, this guy who like did, you know, big things. And you know, this is a name that people know. And she left and she was like, not good enough.
She was like, you call this teaching?
You call this teaching? Yeah. And so after that, she may or may not have studied with Brahms. I have not reached this point in her book, so I don't know what she said. but some sources say she did study with Brahms. Other sources just say that she met Brahms and Clara Schumann.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, like, at the same time. So can you just, like, I want to know what, like, seeing them together would be like, you know?
Yeah.
Because we all know that Brahms was in love with her, and she's just like, nah, but help me raise my kids anyway.
I think it's also funny to imagine her meeting them and then being like, can y'all adopt me into your musical family?
Can y'all adopt me? Oh my god. Yeah.
The gaby.
The gaby! Brahms is gaby. And Clara Schumann, we can't forget the win.
Yes, Brahms and Clara Schumann's like, gaby. That just like came out.
Gaby Ethel. She ended up meeting a lot of famous composers, like, during her time, including Tchaikovsky, who said she was, quote, one of the few women composers whom one can seriously consider to be achieving something valuable in the field of musical creation. Which is, like, a compliment buried in, like...
Yeah, that's, like, a backhanded compliment.
Yeah, it's like, she's good, because women are usually not good.
Yeah.
Which is, like,
that's, like, pretty awful.
Yeah, I mean, but it's... I guess at this point we can take what we can get. Do better, Tchaikovsky.
Do better.
In his defense, well, not in his defense, but like, he was obsessed with men.
So yeah, he probably that's just, true.
Like, you know, he wasn't.
He was like, old woman? Oh yeah, she's doing well. Anyways.
Anyways, my cousin.
Oh my god.
So Tchaikovsky's compliment was kind of rare because she wasn't well received by critics because men are trash. I'm going to read to you a number of quotes. This one is from Wikipedia. Her Wikipedia page says, Smythe's music was seldom evaluated as simply the work of a composer among composers, but as that of a woman composer. This worked to keep her on the margins of the profession, and coupled with the double standard of sexual aesthetics, also placed her in a double bind. On the one hand, when she composed powerful, rhythmically vital music, it was said that her work lacked feminine charm.
Oh my gosh.
On the other, when she produced delicate, melodious compositions, she was accused of not measuring up to the artistic standards of her male colleagues.
Of course.
Yeah, so literally there's like nothing she could have done. She was a woman and the men hated her. Misogyny.
Misogyny.
Mm-hmm. Some more examples. This is from an article by Mental Floss. Most critics gave it, I think in this case it was her opera Der Wald.
Uh-huh.
Most critics gave it a thumbs down anyway. They griped that the music was too beefy for a woman composer.
Oh my gosh.
It was like Wagner took HGH injections.
What?
And then the quote, the actual quote from the review at the time, like the critics' review of the opera said, "This little woman writes music with a masculine hand and has a sound and logical brain such as is supposed to the especial gift of the rougher sex. There is not a weak or effeminate note in Der Wald, nor an unstable sentiment," the Telegraph said. And here's what's wild about that, is that that almost sounds like a compliment, but based off of everything else I've read about that, like, that critic, it was not.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like, she's doing what men do, but better. Therefore, I hate it.
Yeah.
It's like, way to expose your fragile masculinity.
So annoying.
I know. The New York World concurred with the Telegraph in saying, her work is utterly unfeminine. It lacks sweetness and grace of phrase.
Why don't men write feminine? Why don't they do the sweetness?
Right? Right?
Why do women have to do it?
That's exactly. And then when they do, they don't like it anyway.
Yeah.
The New York Commercial Advertiser complained that Smythe had tried too hard to, quote, take the sex element out of her work, end quote, and by compensating had surpassed, quote, in masculinity anything that a man might do.
Good.
Like, literally, I mean, yes, yes, but literally they're like, she did this better than a man would do, which makes it bad.
Yeah.
I'm just so tired. I'm so tired. I don't know how she put up with this.
Yeah. Hopefully she just didn't care.
I
feel like she might have just been like, oh, that sucks. It sucks that I'm better than you.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, so this opera that they're talking about, Der Wald, was performed by the New York Metropolitan Opera. The first time that they ever put on a show by a woman.
Yay. Yeah, that's awesome.
Mm-hmm. That was in 1903. So the first time ever by a woman, 1903. The very next time, the same group. It took until the year 2016.
Oh my god.
For them to put on another show by a woman. That show, by the way, was by Kaija Sarriaho. Oh, I'm so sorry if. no, I'm sorry that I mispronounced that name. And the opera was called L'Amour de Loin. But 2016, that is what, 113 years later?
That's pretty awful.
I know.
And New York Met is canceled. We're canceling the Met.
Oh my god. It's like, it's crazy too, because every mention I saw of like this instance of like the first time was Ethel Smith and the next time was this lady in 2016, every mention I saw of that, and especially when the Met was talking about it, they're just like, look guys, we did this, it was by a woman, congratulate us, as opposed to like, you know, we took a long time to get here. Yeah. Sorry.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah,
I've heard so many like people from the inside of the Met say how problematic it is. So
ooh.
I'm not surprised. Disappointed, but not surprised.
Yeah, that's probably the theme of, like, this whole year.
Yes.
Disappointed, but not surprised. okay, anyway. So let's talk about a little bit about her involvement in the suffrage movement. Ethel Smythe took 2 years off from music to devote her life to the women's suffrage movement. She joined this group called the Women's Social and Political Union, or WSPU. For short, the leader was this woman named Emma Pankhurst, who she was kind of in love with.
Naturally.
Yeah. And reading about Emma Pankhurst, she was like, she was this like well off enough lady who was like, women deserve the right to vote. And she was like really powerful and adamant. She like knew what she believed. And she was in charge of this organization. And like, honestly, I get it. I probably would fall in love with her too.
We love a woman with power.
Yes, exactly. And they're trying to like give all women this power.
Uh-huh.
WSPU was a more radical organization than some others in England at the time. They at first advocated for nonviolent protests, but then later started doing more violent things. I'll get to that in a second. And by the way, the leader, Emma, pointed out that men were doing the same exact violent things to get what they wanted, and it was successful, and no one had a problem with it.
Of course.
Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, these women were being jailed.
Of course.
So, one of the violent things that they did was they, like, found out where all the people in the government lived who did not support women getting the vote. And then they went to their houses and they threw bricks through the windows.
I'm here for it.
Yeah.
I love it.
Yeah. So they did that and a lot of them got arrested, including our lovely Ethel Smythe.
Oh.
And I believe Emma also got arrested. So they get arrested. They go to jail for like 2 months. And then when Ethel's friend this like dude named Thomas Beecham, who I think founded the London Philharmonic. Yeah. So he comes to pick her up from jail, and he gets there, and there's like a courtyard in the prison. Ethel is leaning out the window, conducting like a crowd of women, singing a song that she wrote with a toothbrush. The song became the theme of like the movement for women's suffrage. It's called The March of the Women, and it's the song that we played earlier.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Wow, she did that like a prison? Like she
In a prison. Then... She like the women like gathered and they sang it and she conducted them leaning out a window like with a toothbrush. Like what an icon.
What a sight. That's
amazing. Yeah, she did that. She really did that. I'm so proud of her. I love her. I want to be her.
But also like bringing like music to prisoners in general.
Yeah, also, yes. I didn't even think about that. You're right.
It's such an amazing thing.
Mm-hmm. Abolish the jails, but
yes. Abolish America's... All prisons, actually. I'm just going to say it.
Honestly, abolish America. I'm abolish just tired. America. I'm so tired.
Abolish this whole world. I'm done. I'm going to live in outer space.
Okay. Anyway. So, okay. Now let's talk about her being gay. So there were some more quotes in her book that I did not include here, or that I did not include earlier, and we're going to talk about them now. So she fell in love easily with so many people often, and like, I get it. You know me. You know, it's like, especially when it's not that easy to like find a partner.
Oh, of course.
You know, you just walk into a room and there's a girl. You're like, oh God. Oh my God,
Who is she?
I wasn't prepared for this. Yeah, so that's kind of how she was. Like, she, you know, as you can tell, she was a really strong, really powerful, like, self-assured person. But every time she, like, saw a girl that she liked, she was like, oh my God, I'm so nervous. Oh my God, I don't know what to do. Yeah, so we talked earlier about, like, compulsory heteronormativity. So I also did this where, like, as a kid, I was just like, yeah, boys, that's, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
That sounds right.
Yeah. Exactly. So she had a number of like not schoolyard romances, but like of that age.
Uh-huh.
Like tiny little flings with like the other boys that she knew. And it was really just because what she felt like it should be doing. Here's a quote from her book. I'm going to mention her older sister, Mary, who was 2 years older. They were really close. It had always been an axiom in the family that from the earliest years, Mary had been drawn by me into tomboyish ways that really were foreign to her nature. I think this is probably true. Anyhow, as time went on, boys who began by being attracted by my independence and proficiency in games always ended by forsaking me in order to minister to Mary's more feminine helplessness. Buckling on her skates for her, or in response to a piteous, help me, I'm giddy, flying to her rescue among the higher branches of the old cherry tree. I remember various incidents connected with faithless boy lovers of mine, but to think that in all this I was playing a part, doing what I knew was the correct thing. Now and again, a very real feeling of mortification may have swept over me as I saw my admirers succumbing to the charms of Mary, but from the first, my most ardent sentiments were bestowed on members of my own sex, and the love affairs with boys were but imitative and trashy, I fear. So, like, she knew, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, and I imagine for her, not having any role models who were queer, that, you know, even though she felt like, you know, being in love with women wasn't necessarily a bad thing. Like, what could she do about it?
Right.
You know, which is probably why she was, like, she had, like, these flings, like, for a while. But, like, what she said here about, like, my most ardent sentiments were bestowed on members of my own sex. The first time I ever had feelings for a girl, I was like, whoa. Oh, my God. Like, I had crushes on so many boys, who, by the way, are all gay now. I'd had crushes on so many boys, and I was, like, ready to get married at age 6. But, and then I fell in love with a friend of mine, and I was like, oh, my God. Oh, my God. Like, yeah, I get it. That's changes. Probably what she felt.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. She, like, had, you know, Victorian England, there were, like, balls and dancing. And it was ballroom culture. And she said, okay, so she likes to go to these events because she likes to dance.
Uh-huh.
But everyone else went to, like, pick up people, you know, and flirt and, like, find a husband or a wife. And she said that, you know, it sucked because she just wanted to dance. And she said about this, Then, too, there was the humiliating, infuriating idea that if I was nice to a man, he would think I wanted to marry him. And honestly, that hasn't changed.
No, men have not changed.
Oh my god. The number of times, like, especially, like, after I got to college and I was, like, very open about being gay, the number of times that I would be very loud about this and still guys would be like, hey, so... yeah. Can I remember? I'm like...
Abolish all men.
Abolish all men.
We're done. We're done with men.
We're done.
We're sending them to Mars. They can stay there.
They can stay there.
They can figure it out.
Yeah. Yeah.
Send all men to Mars and have them figure it out over there.
So, as
That's
a...
just so cringe. I'm sorry. I'm so cringing on that last, like...
Yeah.
Like, yeah. A girl just wants to dance. Like,
yeah, she's like, hey, do you want to dance? And he's like, yes, and will you marry me? He's like, no. No. For the last time, this is a there's a dancing floor. It's for dancing. Although, you know what Dr. Stoffel would say is that...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you know, dancing leads to courting, and courting leads to mating.
Shout out to Stoffel.
Shout out to Dr. Stoffel. All right. So, as a lesbian, I have some quotes and some notes about her adventures as a gay woman. So, yeah, I mentioned earlier she got nervous when she talked to girls that she liked, and she said, when in the presence of one of my passions, I was liable under the stress of emotion to extraordinary contortions, such as standing on the outside of my feet, swaying to and fro, brushing the palm of one hand violently against the other in midair, as if one were flint and the other steel.
I love it.
Can you imagine? I mean, I don't have to imagine because I've done some pretty... equally embarrassing things while yes. talking to a girl. There was a girl I once tried to talk to, and I was trying to, like, make a conversation with her, and she was like, I study astrobiology. And I was like, oh, okay. And so what I was trying to say was, like, what is that? Instead, I was like, oh, okay, and I just did that for like 2 entire minutes and she just stood there and let me. I have no idea where she is now. So yeah, like Ethel, I get it. Ethel Smythe, one and the same. Some of the people she fell in love with were Virginia Woolf. Who did not reciprocate the feelings. Ethel was at the time in her like 70s and Virginia was in her 50s or maybe late 40s. And Virginia, like, wasn't into it romantically, but they were friends. She felt. Did you watch the movie The Greatest Showman?
I did not. I did not.
I do like that movie. It's a straight movie, but it's I like it. I think the music is fun. And so that's the one with Hugh Jackman, and so he's like the circus guy, and at some point he like befriends this opera singer named Jenny Lind. And they, like, he starts taking her on tour around, like, America or whatever, and then she, like, falls in love with him, and he's just, like, I don't know, whatever. The point is that she is a real person, and Ethel Smythe was in love with her and got to work with her, too.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So that was really cool to find out.
Real-world connections.
Yeah.
Love to see it.
Mm-hmm. So here, the next bit is really cool, I think. In Googling Ethel Smythe, I found an article about somebody else named Mary Benson. Mary was the wife of an archbishop in England. And the article was about how their whole, pretty much their whole family was gay. And the husband, like the archbishop, was just like, you know? Yeah. Yeah, the husband was like okay with all of her affairs with women, except for one person named Ethel.
Oh my gosh.
The only time, this is from the History Channel, the only time one of Mary's companions caused major upheaval in the Benson household came in 1889 when Mary fell for a younger composer named Ethel Smythe. The reasons for which I love you are unshakable, Smythe wrote Mary in a letter. Here are some of them. Your truth, your fire, your intensity, your power of sustained effort, your extraordinary grip over other souls, your intellect, and above all, in the words of a prayer I like, your unconquerable heart.
Oh my gosh.
How gay is that? That's so beautiful. It sounds, yeah, that sounds like some text that I sent to Sam when we first started dating.
Aww.
Honestly, yeah. Side note, we would send texts like that to each other, and then one of us would interrupt and be like, wow, that was super gay. And it's true. Okay, anyway. Edward, the archbishop, the husband, disliked Smythe, who had come to marry after another married woman's family had banished her. But the real problem came when Smythe fell in love with another Benson, Nellie, Mary's daughter. And Nellie was besotted back.
Oh, what?
Drama. Lesbian what? Drama, right? The two were much closer in age. At the time, Nellie was 26, Smythe was 31, and Mary was 48. Even though from a philosophical standpoint, Mary saw the sense in accommodating their relationship, she was clearly chagrined. "I feel now that I must stand aside in the matter and leave you two alone," she wrote Smythe.
Wow.
Yeah, so...
What?
Yeah.
That's insane.
I know!
I feel like this is something you hear about, like, on, like, drama TV shows.
Yeah,
like,
I know!
Like, real life, like, I don't know, like, Jerry, like...
Yeah, you know, like... I know. This happened in real life to my past life. Like, I don't know that much about, like, other lesbians because I didn't really know many until I met Sam. And I didn't, like, date and experience. But from what I understand, like, lesbians are super happy to date much older lesbians. Case in point, you know, what's her name? The actress, Sarah Paulson?
Uh-huh.
Her girlfriend, who's also an actor, is, like, 30 years older than she is or something.
Oh, really?
Uh-huh. They're super happy. Yeah. I'm just thinking about that. Just, like, you know, this isn't that out of left field, you know? This is just what lesbians do.
I know, but the family thing.
I know, the family. I don't think I could do that.
That's insane. I've, like, definitely dated, like, people who have, like, checked out my parents in front of me.
Oh, my God. Yeah,
like, I went on a date with... No, I, like, brought some guy home, and he's a bisexual, and he, like, came to my house and checked out both of my parents and then told me after, he was like, "Oh, your parents look really good." And I was like, "Excuse me?
Oh, my,
like,
God."
I was like, wow. Like, yeah.
Oh, my God. So, that's so funny.
That's a little weird.
I'm here for bisexuality, as always. However, if you're on a date with somebody, you shouldn't be checking out other people, much less their parents. Oh, yeah, my God.
That was a lot.
Oh my God, I'm so sorry.
It's okay.
Oh my Jesus. Okay. I also wanted to read this one quote from that article from the History Channel about Mary Benson. At the top, it said, so it's saying how, like, gay people weren't that uncommon in Victorian times, like we were led to believe. But he said, "This isn't to say that acting on same-sex desire was safe in Victorian times. The punishment for sex between men was death until 1861, when it was downgraded to a minimum of 10 years prison labor."
Oh my God.
I know, awful. "Sex between women was not punishable by law, but that was because such intimacies were largely invisible to those in charge. Close female friendships appeared prevalent, but lesbianism was not yet a definable concept."
That's hilarious to me.
Yeah.
It's just like, I think it's so funny because it just like proves that men can't like hold it in their pants.
Yeah.
It's like, oh my God, they're on the street doing it. They're like all over the place.
God.
We can see it. Y'all are gonna die.
Oh my
God. But like
God.
Women are like, we're gonna hide it. We're like, oh, we're best friends. I love it.
Yeah.
I'm so here for it.
Oh my God. Well, to be fair, there is a history of people just like refusing to like accept that like lesbians exist, you know? Think about it like homophobes' problems with men is that they're with gay men.
Yeah.
Is that they're feminine and that they you know, have sex in ways that they think are weird.
Yeah, of course.
You know.
Yeah.
And homophobes' problems with lesbians is that they're not interested in men.
Right.
You know?
That's exactly it.
Right. So like, and I've been thinking about this a lot, like, in our, like, patriarchal societies like this, like, the biggest crime is to be a woman.
Uh-huh.
Like, if we just ignore race for a second, the biggest crime is to be a woman, right? So if a man acts like a woman, that's bad. If a woman acts like a man, less bad, because we all should be men, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I totally get, yeah.
Yeah, so it's easier for women to get away with that stuff, because it's just like, wow, she's weird and we don't like her, but, like, I kind of like it, you know?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's, like, so true of, like, even the LGBT community, like, how, like, gay people that can fit into the binary, like, you know, cisgender gay, like, men and women, like, often have much easier time than people that are, like, non-binary.
Yeah.
Or they don't conform to a gender identity, like, per se, or they're transgender. Like, that's, like, so awful that we... Not we necessarily, but people in our community will, like, see them and be like, oh, it sucks. We can, like, we can fit in with the straighties, heteronormativity, but you can't. And they, like, they turn their eyes, you know, like, they turn their head around. They don't, they pretend they don't exist, which is, like, so awful.
Yeah. Man. Sometimes we suck.
Yeah. That's so terrible.
I know.
You know what else this reminds me of, though? Is that I feel like, okay, at least in my secondary lived experience with, like, queer women that I know, like, their relationship with their sexuality has always come through, like, best friends. Like, finding, like, really best friends in their, like, growing up and being like, oh, damn, this is not a friend. Like, I'm a
Yeah, oh my god,
like,
yeah.
All of my, like, lesbian friends have always been like, oh, sh-. Like,
yeah, so, you're just, like, hanging out being gal pals and you're like, uh-oh.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Which, like, did not happen to me at all because I never fit in with, like, the boys, really. Mm. So, like, guys I had crushes on, I, like, didn't even know them, you know, per se. Mm-hmm. So, it's like, wow. I think it's funny that that's, like, a similar thread that I've had with all of my lesbian friends.
Yeah.
Like, it's always, like, their best friend, and then they're like, oh, shit. Like,
yeah. Yeah, best friend, and then, oh, shit. Yeah. Yeah. What was I going to say? Yeah, I mean, women are, like, trained to, or, like, girls are trained to, like, embrace their emotions, and boys are not. So then maybe that's part of it. It's, like, the friendships between boys growing up, like, if you're, like, gushy and emotionally close, then it's kind of like, ew, you're a girl.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So maybe that's part of it. I'm sorry you don't get to experience that.
No, no. I mean, I don't know. I feel like having, like, been the gay friend helping, like, my lesbian friends, like, come out, like, yes, sweetie, that means you're gay. And they're like, no, no, but I think this guy's cute. And I'm like, do you? And they're like, no. I know you don't.
I know you don't. Oh, my God. You know this, but, like, I came out to myself at 16 as not straight. And then a year later, I was like, okay, so I guess I'm bi. So, I was 17, like, 18 when I was like, okay, I'm bi. And then when I was 19, I was like, oh, I'm not bi, I'm gay. Which I feel kind of bad about because a lot of people, like, don't believe in bisexuality, you know? And they're just like, oh, it's just, like, a stop on the way to, like, being gay or to being straight or whatever.
Yeah.
Which, so I feel bad that I, like, a little bit contributed to that incorrect myth. But that, I don't know, that's just my experience.
I don't think you're to blame, though. I feel like it's partially, like, the way our society pushes us to believe that we're in, like, oh, like, we have to like men somehow, right?
Yeah.
Like, even though I feel certainly a different way for each of them.
Mm-hmm.
So I totally get it. I don't think you're to blame for that.
Okay, thank you.
But it's, like, also, yeah, I don't know. I mean, I hate the, like, bi erasure thing that's always happening. Because I know, like, so many bisexual people that are, like, you know, they don't, like, fit into the stereotypes that people like to put out, which is really annoying.
Yeah, and so, like, because people have these stereotypes, and then someone is like, hi, I'm bi, they're like, no, you're not.
Yeah, yeah.
You don't look like what I think a bi is supposed to be.
Right, you're, like, people, like, the people are like, oh, you're bi when you, like, have a couple of drinks with your, like, best friends that are girls, or something like that. It's like, no, that's not what, no.
I know.
I'm, like, truly bi, like... Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and, like, bisexual erasure is so real. Sam actually recently decided that she was bi. Not decided, but realized and accepted.
Uh-huh.
And it's been something that's, like, kind of been in the back of her mind for a long time.
You know what? That's so interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Because I feel like also there's, like, push, just like you were talking about with, like, the, you know, half Korean, half American, like, white thing.
Yeah, yeah.
It's, like, you don't fit into a certain place. And then I feel like a lot of people who are bi feel, like, a pushback from both sexualities as well, like gay and straight. They go, you don't fit in with us, you don't fit in with us.
Yeah, it sucks that even the gays are like, bi people don't exist. And I hate that. It's, yeah.
Abolish the gays.
Abolish the gays! Except for you and me.
Okay, yeah.
And our partners.
And all our queeros.
Yes, and our queeros. Yeah. So, but yeah, it took her so long to like be like, you know what, this is what I am. I'm not going to like push any part of myself away.
Uh-huh.
You know what part of it did it, like really solidified it for her was, do you watch Brooklyn Nine-Nine?
I watched a couple of episodes because you told me to.
Oh, yeah.
I remember I started watching it a little bit, yeah.
It's so good. Anyway, one of the characters, Rosa Diaz, is the one that like all the women are, like in real life, the people watching the show, all the women are in love with her.
Uh-huh.
She's this badass, like she doesn't take anybody's shit, and she's beautiful.
Yeah.
And in season, I want to say five, season five, she comes out as bi, and she they say the word bisexual on TV, on like network TV multiple times, uh-huh. which is amazing. And she like, you know, she has a real experience. She comes out to her parents, and they don't accept her, but all her friends are like, you know, we got you.
Right.
And just, like, seeing her be super confident and have relationships with men and women, like, Sam was like, oh, yeah, okay, yeah. You know?
I love that.
Yeah.
I
Representation really love that. Matters!
Yes. Yeah. It's
yeah.
true.
Mm-hmm.
I've, like, for, like, a weird reason, I've always had, like, a lot of my, like, romantic connections have always been, like, with bisexual men.
Mm.
And a lot of them didn't find out until much later in their life. Mm. And it's, like, the same, like, how can you accept that, like, when you're, like, married with children? And then you're, like, oh, crap. Like,
yeah.
There's a whole other side of my sexuality that I never discovered.
Yeah.
So it's, it's really unfortunate that we don't, like, that's, like, just starting to, like, be a thing. Even then, like.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, we got a lot of work to do, queeros.
Yeah, queeros. Is that what we're calling our people?
I think if they would like to be called queeros,
if
then
they,
yes.
Yeah, exactly. You know, we're not going to call anybody anything that they don't want to be called.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. We're inclusive here.
Yes.
This is a safe space. I wanted to finish with a couple of quotes that I really liked from her book that just kind of like encapsulate for me what I feel like her character is. They're kind of silly, kind of just like, yeah, okay. So they're all from her childhood. Here's one. British accent. There is one more memory, dateless but imperishable, because I was never allowed to hear the end of it, an occasion on which all unconsciously a life's philosophy was formulated. Once Grandmama helped me to some pudding, and seeing I did not touch it, exclaimed, "Why, I thought that was your favorite pudding." My answer was, "Yes, but this is so little, I can't eat it."
Wow.
I know, right? She's like, I deserve more, so I'm going to walk away from this pudding until I get what I deserve.
That's totally, I feel that. In my
I feel like that's exactly who she was, like, in all of her stuff. She walked away from the Leipzig Conservatory because she's like, yes, I have this music education that I finally wanted, but it's not enough, so I'm going to leave, you know? Like, I have the music, like, career that I finally wanted, but women don't have the vote, so I'm going to leave until I get that, you know?
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly. She's such a queen.
I love that.
Oh, this reminds me, did you hear of the story of, there's a show called I May Destroy You that just came out on HBO.
Oh, and no, I don't know it.
Yeah, I haven't watched it. I think I probably won't because it seems, like, pretty heavy. The actress slash writer creator of the show is named Michaela Cole, and she, like, has a show on Netflix already, and she, like, wrote the show, pitched it to Netflix, and Netflix is like, all right, we're gonna give you $1 million for this deal, and she was like, okay, yay, and they're like, but you can't have any creative control over this, you don't own the copyright to this anymore, and so she was like, oh, well, maybe I should, and her agents were like, yeah, maybe you should, because they were secretly gonna get a cut.
Uh-huh.
That she wasn't going to get.
Uh-huh. Of course.
So they were like, yeah, you should do it. And she was like, maybe can I get like 5% of the copyright? Maybe can I get 3%? And they were like, no, we don't do that here. So she eventually was like, no, I'm not going to do this. She walked away from that $1 million deal and then sold it to, was it HBO? No, it was BBC. And she got like the creative control that she deserved.
Wow.
You know? So same thing, you know?
Netflix.
I know.
So annoying.
I know. But anyway, so like you know, women standing up for what they deserve and knowing what they're worth. That's amazing. I love to see it.
Yeah.
Yes. Okay, here's another quote. This is just silly. My father once wrote and pinned on the wall, "If you have nothing pleasant to say, hold your tongue." An adage which, though excellent as a receipt for getting on in society, was unpopular in a nursery such as ours, for words led to blows, and we happened to love fighting. I just think that's so funny.
That's amazing.
Yeah. Like, yeah, she would talk about how she fought with her siblings, like, for fun, with, like, knives. Oh. Yeah. Somehow they all end up alive.
Disaster.
I know. Okay, and then the last one I just thought was kind of cute. She was talking about, like, a magician, which they call the conjurer, uh-huh. at, like, a party, and she said, "For my part, as soon as I realized I should never guess how these tricks are done, conjuring rather exasperated me, my feelings then as now being, what's the fun of not understanding?" Yeah, which is, like, that's so cute and funny, but also, like, it's true. Like, what's the fun of not, like, what's the fun of participating in a world where you don't get to know what's going on?
Yeah.
You know? So she was like, I'm going to know what's going on. I'm going to learn all this music. I'm going to figure out how to get women to vote. I'm going to, you know.
Yeah.
I'm going to know what real love is with a woman. Yeah.
That's so funny. Mm-hmm. I've always felt that about magic shows, too.
Really?
Yeah. I was like, I want to know what's going on. Otherwise, I'm bored. Like,
yeah. I want to be the magician. I don't really want to watch the magician.
Yeah. I want to know what's going
on. Yeah.
I really liked the show where they, like, showed how to do all the magic tricks. But all the, like, the magic shows, I was just like, oh, this is boring. But when they showed, like, oh, this is how they do this, I'm like, oh. And it's, like, saucy. It's like, oh, I know what's going on now.
Oh, my God. Yeah. But yeah, so that's our Dame Ethel Smythe. She was given the damehood. Is that how you say that?
Like, damehood?
Well, it's like knighthood if you're a man. You get knighted and you are Sir so-and-so if you're a man. And if you're a woman, you become a dame.
Oh, I did not even know that.
Yeah, so a dame is like the woman version of a knight.
Wow.
In England. And she was bestowed the title of Dame Ethel Smythe for her contributions to music, which is super cool. I think she was the first woman to do so in music.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. And so, like,
you learn something new every day.
Yeah, we learned so much today.
Yeah, we did.
Yeah. Ethel, if you're out there, or if you're, like, in my past lives, I just want you to know that I love you, and I look up to you, and thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for doing everything you did and for putting up with Med's bullshit. She lived until she was, like, 86.
Amazing.
Yeah, for 86 years, you put up with Med's bullshit. And I just want to thank you for that.
I'm, like, inspired now. Yeah. She was so amazing.
She was. She didn't take anybody. Like, she was who she was, and I love her.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That's amazing. I love it.
A queen. A queen. Definitely, like, you and any listeners should, like, look up her books and read them.
Yeah.
Sometimes they're hard to get through because sometimes she's talking about stuff you don't care about. But then she's talking about, you know, the women that she, you know, fell in love with and that kind of stuff. And it's just, it's so great. She's so unstuffy, like I said. And she was not shy about her, what did they say? She was not shy about her nonconformist sexual identity. But yeah.
Do you have any recommended listening for?
Oh yeah, so she wrote a lot of good stuff. One of her things was a mass in D. I don't know enough about masses and choral music to know if it was good. I'm sure it was great. There was one man composer who was like. Like, he heard that, and he was like, this has forever abolished the idea in my mind that women can't do music.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. He, like, from that point on, he was like, women can do music. Which is like, you know, all right, I'll take it.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah. So she wrote a mass in D. She wrote several operas, some comic. I think some were comic, some were tragic. And my favorite piece that she wrote is a concerto for violin and horn.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
It's called Concerto for Violin and Horn. It's really pretty. And, you know, Sam, my partner, is a horn player, and I played part of it for her, and she was like, ooh, yes. So, you know, it's good.
Do I hear a flute and horn concerto version coming out at some point
soon? I thought about it. I think it's a little too idiomatic for violin, but I might just do it anyway.
Just do it.
Yeah. And then, of course, there's her march for the March of the Women, which is, you can listen to that anywhere. It's one of her most famous pieces because it was like the theme song of the women's suffrage movement in England.
Right. Mm-hmm, so. And we played it.
Yeah. And we played it. Yeah. We
killed it.
Yeah, we did. Oh, my God. So what are we supposed to say at the end of podcasts? Like, we have websites, aliceparkmusic.com and also
shahidflute.com.
Yeah. Listen to our podcast and rate us as 5 stars because we're great, I hope. And
go throw a brick in a man's window.
Yeah! That's what we gotta do. Be like Ethel.